Today we're going to look at nurturance from the biblical perspective. And the model that you see in front of you in the handout is really what we'll talk about, but with a few asides and some discussion, I hope, related to how to fit a nurturing model within the background of the Bible, which is certainly the piece that seems to fit for me. As I started to study this topic, it's certainly, I guess I realized that I must have been called to study this topic out of my faith background, because so much of it felt very comfortable. Nursing being that profession which looks at nurturing the person to a holistic health perspective through an ethic of caring, that certainly fits within the biblical perspective. So that is what we will look at today. And I would like to start out with a reading during which I think you'll pick out some nurturant behaviors among healthcare providers with an 11-year-old young lady. Gertrude is her name, and she is an 11-year-old sixth grader who enjoys playing the piano and composing music. She's involved in community theater, and both as an actress and in set building. So that's who she is. She's 11 and doing all of those things. This is from the book The Patient's Voice, Experiences of Illness, which is a new find for me that I'm using with my nursing students. But Gertrude was born 8 weeks prematurely with multiple systems abnormality. Her parents were told that the babies were born with MSA, that babies who were born with MSA never survived beyond the first year without surgical correction, that she would never learn to walk, and that she would have limited intelligence. Gertrude has survived cardiac tests, lengthy procedures, completed convalescences. Here she shares her memories of those years and the ways in which she has triumphed despite a medical history as big as a football field. And this story is written from her perspective as an 11-year-old, which I think is marvelous. This is the story of Gertrude Simpson, and I won't read you the whole thing, but just some excerpts from it. Age 11 with a medical history as big as a football field. The stuff that I can remember begins when I was about 2.5 years old. I was in a room having some sort of test. I was crying. The doctor tried to cheer me up. His name was Dr. Colt. I thought of him as a kind of a snowman because his name was Colt. And there was Dr. Berger. I thought of him as Mr. Hamburger. There was one more, Dr. William. One day I needed x-rays and I was on the table. Dr. William and my mom were both wearing blue x-ray spacesuits. Suddenly, out of the blue, I called him Dr. Dummy. I don't know why. He is one of the most important and strict doctors in the world, but surprisingly enough, he liked it, and to this day, he still does. I should also mention the nurses and doctors at home, like Lisa and Shirley and Dr. Johns and Linda Harrison. They were special. Now back to the beginning. Dr. Colt did a really good Donald Duck voice, or at least I thought so. He pulled out a Donald Duck puppet and made me laugh. The thing that made me remember this so well is that out of all the doctors in history, barely any of them can make a joke. I think that doctors should make jokes because it makes you feel more secure around your doctor. The next thing that I remember was being in the hospital for 14 weeks. When I first came on the unit, we opened 2 blue swinging doors with chicken wire on the windows. We walked in the doors and there was an empty bed and on the left side of the doors. I remember nurses named Fran and Patty who met us at the door. Patty was wearing blue surgery clothes and something to cover her hair. Patty has played a big role in my hospital life, but I'll write about her later. I have a perfect picture of the hospital room in my mind, even though I was only 2.5 years old. I was in the last bed on the left. There were some kids across from me on beds. Next to them there were 2 brown doors. Can you just hear? I mean, this is when she was 2.5 and she's got all these memories. If you entered those, you would go into the unit lobby. There were also doors across the room on the wide side of the room. One of the few things that I remember about Division 14 was green, wet, buttery beans. We all had a window by our bed. I would always eat my green beans sitting cross-legged by my window. And my mother, and another thing, I have always hated cold ice cream. The hospital always used to serve me ice cream. Since I hated it cold, Karen, my primary nurse, would take the ice cream and put it on the sunny windowsill to turn it into ice cream soup. Since ice cream was a very important possession to me, I would have Karen put the ice cream in the freezer for my sister so that she could eat it when she came to visit. Sometimes the ice cream would sit in the freezer for 2 weeks at a time because she didn't visit often. She lived too far away. Just to begin, I'll read a little bit more of that later. But what I think that gives us is some idea of how important all of those little things are in the memory of an 11-year-old child, certainly. And those are the things that those little things that people do, those attending to the unique needs of others, was something that we talked about in the last couple days, acknowledging the individuality of the other. And in these excerpts, that is a thread that flows through many of them, particularly for this 11-year-old girl. That's what she remembers. She doesn't remember, you know, the things like the professionals may tend to, like that the medications were given on time and that the aseptic technique was held to and all of those kinds of things. What she remembers is the ice cream soup and the green buttery beans and the Donald Duck doctor and those kinds of things. Those have meaning to her. And that's what I want to talk a little bit more about today. The things that have meaning for us as people are the things that seem to nurture us. And we get those ideas from the scriptures. And that's where I want to head. After a little introduction on why to be worried about nurturance and what's important about it, I have viewed nurturance as a health promotion approach toward violence prevention in families and communities. And just a few little quips here. Interpersonal violence is a major public health concern. That's a statistic from the Centers for Disease Control and Protection. Children who witness family violence are much more likely to demonstrate antisocial behaviors, abuse toward others, and internalized responses, things like anorexia, depression, suicidal attempts. And then, that 14 out of every 100 children between the ages of 3 and 17 years have experienced family violence. Now look at this old statistic, 1978. I bet it's higher than that. What do you think? Those were the most recent statistics in terms of the whole nation. Prevention of family violence requires promotion of optimal parenting and reduced family stress. So that if we're going to do that, how do we look at it? For me, as a professional who's working with a lot of families, I know that nurturance is essential for promotion of family competence. A family is a microcosm of our society. A family is the environment in which siblings learn to fight, to make up, siblings learn to negotiate. Children deal with adults within that trusting relationship. There's a lot of trust, untrust that's learned within families that then links to the rest of their life. So the family is really the small little microcosm of society, a teaching field, so to speak. Nurturance then is also a protective factor, and this is found in the research. It's a protective factor against the risk of teenage pregnancy, child abuse and neglect, and low self-esteem. And the last one we're not going to deal totally strictly with today. We're going to look at it a little bit broader, but parental nurturance truly has not been clearly defined. What is it that parents need to do to nurture their children? And that's part of what I've looked at. Are the flies getting you still over there? Okay. So now I'm going to take a look just at your handout, which shows the antecedents to nurturance first. And antecedents are the things that have to come before nurturing. We'll talk a little bit about what is nurturing eventually. But antecedents mean this is what has to happen in order for nurturing to take place. And so the first things that you'll see are these. That there needs to be a sense of responsibility on the part of the person who's going to nurture. We've talked a bit about that. And those are in the Romans and Galatians passages. In Romans, what I want to highlight is that the last couple lines, love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor, therefore love is fulfilling of the law. And in Galatians, the last line, let us work for the good of all and especially for those of the family of faith. So this gives us our Christian responsibility. There are many more passages in the Bible that speak to this. But as Christians, we have an imperative and a sense of responsibility. Then moving on to the ability to identify needs. That was a clap. That was an insect death.
I missed.
Oh no, not a...
Not. Attempted.
An attempted death. Attempted homicidal fly.
Murder.
So the first two, and you'll notice as we go through here, many of these, when we're talking about nurturance, are New Testament passages. Some of you are, we're working with Darius Larson in the Bible study on studying Genesis and learning some really interesting things there. But when he and I dialogued a bit, he said, Genesis probably isn't the most nurturing chapter. This is probably not, we probably don't have a lot of nurturing passages in Genesis. But there are some things that we glean that are wonderful and helpful from the Old Testament in terms of family life in the Proverbs later on. But most of the imperatives to caring and to nurturance come from the New Testament, come from the disciples learning what it is this new Christian faith is, from communities struggling with those issues, from Jesus talking about what life in relationship is truly about. So that's the antecedents, surprisingly enough, not surprising, come a lot from the New Testament. The ability to identify needs in Ephesians, lead a worthy life of the calling to which you've been called with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love. And then in Mark, he took her by the hand and said to her, Talitha cum, which means, little girl, get up. And immediately the girl got up and began to walk. She was 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. You see, so Jesus here is the prime example of someone who identifies needs. Okay, so now he's healed her, he's gotten on the road. Okay, now give her something to eat. And pay attention to those basic needs. And then get out of it. Related to positive self-worth, there is a Genesis passage. But 1 John, John 3, is on your handout first. See what love the Father has given us, that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are. We are children of God. And what better way to look at having a sense of positive self-worth? That we are created in God's image, and that's what the next passage is about. This is the first story in Genesis, which speaks of humankind. Let us make humankind in our own image according to our likeness. And then if you'll just skip to the last line, a couple lines there. God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. And Darius talked about this is Tov. This is the best. This is really good. He was pleased with humankind. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. Have you thought about that? Have you thought about, and this is God. God is feeling at this point in life now, when he's just created these folks, this is good. This is really good. And so this is the sense of positive self-worth that we all as Christians should be able to, able and willing to live with. Sometimes it's a struggle, isn't it? But it is where we come from. And then the ethic of caring. Matthew 22:34-40, I'm going to just skip to the last line of this too. You can read the rest as you go. But on these commandments hang all the law and the prophets. He said to them, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment, and second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself and care for your neighbor. Romans, but God proves his love for us in that while we still were sinners, Christ died for us. What an ultimate act of caring that was for us. And then in Matthew 10:29-31, I love those sparrow stories. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet no, not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. Your Father knows. And even the hairs of your head are counted, so do not be afraid. You are of more value than many sparrows. So God knows the sparrows, he knows the hairs on your head, and therefore you are the person that has not only the self-worth and the responsibility, but the ability to care. Have you thought of this? Have you thought about your calling to be a nurturer? Any thoughts about that and where you come from as a nurturer Christian? Yes.
When my sister was widowed at age 30, she lived in the same town I did, and I was talking with my father who lived long distance, because I was very concerned about her. And he goes, I'm the only nurturer in my family. You know, visibly nurturing, I mean, I prefer a little standoffish manner. And he goes, well, she has to go through it alone. And I'd say, yeah, she does, but she doesn't have to be alone. Yeah, there's a difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he never did understand.
Uh-huh.
He never did. But that's how I feel. I mean, yes, I have my struggles, and each one of us does, but you don't have to be alone while you're struggling.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember when the sparrow story especially, I was just out of college and had a job, moved into an apartment, and I was going to a church in Bellevue, and the pastor had come to visit me sometime, you know, later at a time, but when we did communion and he said my name, knowing the number of hairs on your head was the verse that came to me. It really meant a lot.
It does, and you have those aha moments when you realize, oh, well, if God knows the hairs on my head, I guess, you know, perhaps I have that worth, have that value. And I often think when I meet and know people who don't have a faith background, how difficult it must be for them to go through some of the trials in life that they're going through. And I don't know if you think about that, or if you're at many different points in your life, you have thought about that. In my practice, I think about that a lot, and it does make a significant difference when people particularly are going through something critically traumatic, unexpected, not to have something to hang on. And it gives us pause to be thankful, I think, to our ancestors for sharing their faith with us. And taking the time, all those Sunday school teachers and pastors in our background and families that took the time to share the faith with us so that we have an understanding of what that means for us as nurturers in this society. There is some research being done on the feminist perspective of the Old Testament. There have been a couple camps in the feminist movement where some feminists have kind of just tried to disregard particularly parts of the Old Testament because it has been written from a very patriarchal perspective. That is what history was at that time. But then there's another camp that truly has looked at the original texts and looked at the fact that many of the passages and reference to God were not necessarily singly male, but that and or if they were, they were nurturing males, and that the Hebrew male at the time of some of the writings was much more nurturing than the texts would have you believe. So it's an interesting thought, and we'll talk about that probably more as we talk about family nurturance, that in history, Hebrew males had much more of a role in what we call nurturing. And that just gives us pause to think about where God is coming from, where the Creator is having his or her understanding about creation and about nurturing children, nurturing each other. Okay, let's look then. Some of my favorites are coming up here in the defining attributes, which means just the things that are involved in nurturing. First, communication. And communication starts with James, but then it's just filled with these proverbs that are so, so wonderful. First James, you must understand this, my beloved. Let everyone be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. James, we're learning about living in community. And then the proverbs. These would be nice refrigerator proverbs. You know, put on your refrigerator, tack them up to remember. Rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. Isn't that neat and true? Those who guard their mouths preserve their lives. Those who open wide their lips come to ruin. One who spares words is knowledgeable. One who is cool in spirit and understanding. Even fools who keep silent are considered wise. When they close their lips, they are deemed intelligent. And that speaks to the listening part of communication. Sometimes we're so quick, particularly, I have to admit, my teenager, you know, you just want to give them your advice. You want to tell them, well, I've been there, I know what you're going through, I want to prevent this pain for you, but they have to go through it. And it's so hard just to listen, isn't it? It's so hard to sit back and let them experience that. And that's part of some of the boundaries. But some of it is just the importance of listening. Proverbs 18:13, if one gives answer before hearing, it is folly and shame. And the next one, do you see someone who is hasty in speech? There is more hope for a fool than for anyone like that. Proverbs 15, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh one stirs up anger. And then Ephesians, but speaking in truth in love, we must grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ. And lastly, do not let loyalty and faithlessness forsake you.
Faithfulness.
Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. It's missing a T at the end. So carrying loyalty and faithfulness with you in your communication style. Loyalty and faithfulness. Have any of you spent a lot of time studying the Proverbs and looking at the history of Proverbs? I am not a biblical scholar. I am a daily scholar of the Bible. I take it and use the concordance, but I don't have a theological training background. And so I don't have I don't exegete the text. I don't do historical commentary on the text. You need to look to someone else for that. But if any of you have studied the Proverbs, the origin of the Proverbs and where they came from and what they meant?
I once read it over the bestseller on the website.
Okay.
But I don't know, this is just something I heard.
Okay. It would be interesting to know, wouldn't it, the author's family system background, and to know what he was thinking, or she was thinking, when he wrote these. Do you have anybody else have any thoughts?
Well, I do agree that this is Solomon that wrote it, and you know, that was his request of God, is to be wise. Mm-hmm. And certainly, they are wise.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they're just practical common sense that anybody can follow.
Right.
You know,
right.
For Solomon's time, ours too.
Proverbs is part of the wisdom literature, so it's written just as a help for daily life. How do you get along with people? How do you live day to day as God would intend? So the wisdom literature, which includes Proverbs, is there as good advice. This is how to live your life.
Mm-hmm. I often wonder, you know, we as Christians have used the Bible as our guide for a long time. But every once in a while, you'll see, in particular, that the psychological literature, like a new discovery. Well, you know, if you go back to Proverbs, we've known this stuff for a long time. but I'm glad that it keeps coming up. But it really just speaks to what wisdom the Bible gives us for all of life. If the Proverbs that were written, many, many years ago are still applicable today. How wise that is. So that gives a good background, a good template for us to come from. The next one is comforting. In Mark. This is one of my favorites because I'm a children's choir director at our church, and one of my most favorite songs to have the children sing, they do with the adults, and it's called Let the Children Come Unto Me, and the adults sing, and the children's voices come in, and it's just beautiful, and they sing, Let the children come unto me, let the children come to me. Children stay, don't send them away. And then the adults come in, and oh, it's just, it's like, it's, it makes the hair stand up on your arms, because it feels like it recreates that image in my mind of Jesus sitting there in his white robe. I've always got him in a white robe, on a big rock. And the disciples are trying to shoo these children away from this important master, and he's saying, no, let them come to me. I want to be around the children. I want to see them. I want to experience them. And a lot of the psychological literature coming out, the self-help literature, gives you lists of things to do to stay focused and to stay in the real world. And a lot of it says, spend time with the child. And I think, my goodness, here we have Jesus years ago saying, let the children come unto me. And now I see in the literature, you know, one of the 8 things or one of the 10 things to do to stay focused and motivated is spend time with the child. And so Jesus knew that way a long time ago. Children are uninhibited, they are honest, they are wonderful. I spent time yesterday morning, I don't know if any of you have children in Narnia, but I spent time talking about Florence Nightingale, the first professional nurse, and then I did relaxation exercises with the older children and the younger children, and I did relaxation exercises with these little 3-year-olds, 2- and 3-year-olds, and it's a hoot, you know, because they're sitting around this table and they're just action-packed, but I had them put their heads down, and I did a brief relaxation exercise, and then they popped their heads up when I was done with it. And they said, I said, do you think there's any time when you can use this? When you can do this relaxing? And they said, yes, like when I have a nightmare about, and then they told, you know, she told me this nightmare she usually has. I said, yes, I think you could use this. Or somebody will say, when I'm really having a hard time falling asleep because I have had a fun night. Yes, you could use this relaxation exercise. You know, so they are so wonderfully honest about what they can do, what you know, the conversations just are wonderful. And then the most fun thing for me was yesterday that I'd done this in the morning, and then the afternoon, wherever I saw these kids, they say, oh, hi. You know, they love you just for who you are and what you can tell them. Oh, there's the nurse. And they introduce me to their parents or whatever, you know. Children are truly wonderful, and we have. I think that it's important to just continue to remember how wonderful they are, even though they're a lot of work, right? When you have, particularly when you're young children, it's a lot of work, but they're wonderful. They give you a perspective on the world that doesn't exist anywhere else, and so particularly my youngest now is now 9, and I'm thinking, well, to stay connected with those little 3-year-olds is a lot of fun for me. So for those of you who still have young children, I hope you can truly still enjoy that and then continue to do so as your children grow up. So that was Mark, and that's the story, and I won't go into it anymore, except that Jesus wants the children to come to him. And then support, and Jesus brings the children to him at that point to comfort them. And then support in Hebrews, and let us consider how to provoke one another to love and good deeds, not neglecting to meet together in support, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. So encouraging and supporting one another is what's important in Hebrews. And then praising, again, Proverbs. Pleasant words are like, and this is just drippy, isn't it? Pleasant words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the body. And those of you who were in the discussion yesterday about mind, body, spirit, look at this proverb way back when that put us together as mind, body, spirit, soul, and health. And then Proverbs 25:11, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in a silver setting. And Philippians, I thank my God every time I remember you, constantly praying with joy in every one of my prayers for all of you. Because of your sharing in the gospel from the first day until now, I am confident of this, that one who began a good work among you will bring it to completion by the day of Jesus Christ. Just kind of honoring and praising you for who you are. I thank my God every day for who you are. This is one of the passages that one of the assistants to the bishop in our our synod uses a lot in his communications with pastors and families. I think it's wonderful. I thank my God every day, every time I remember you. And so there's a wonderful word of praise and acceptance. And then going to Mark, looking at acceptance. A leper came to him begging him, and kneeling he said to him, "If you choose, you can make me clean." Moved with pity, and so here's Jesus now, moved with pity and identifying needs, right, and feeling a sense of responsibility, Jesus stretches out his hand and touches him and says to him, "I do choose, be made clean." Immediately the leprosy left him and he was made clean. A miracle. But because Jesus recognized that need. And then in Luke, "But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough to spare? But here I am dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like your hired hands.' But what does the father do? So he set off and went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him." And then the discipline passages, some of them are quite long, so I'm going to pick out some of the things. The first is Ephesians, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you," and you, not your, "and you may live long on the earth. And fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord." I think this speaks a lot to the whole idea of parent and child relationships, and to the need to, and the call for us as Christians to examine the issue of family violence and to look at what it is that provokes each other to anger in family systems. And then Hebrews, I'm going to skip to the bottom six lines. "For they disciplined us for a short time." Oh no, "Moreover, we had human parents to discipline us, and we respected them. Should we not be even more willing to be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time, as seemed best for them. But he disciplines us for our good, in order that we may share his holiness. Now, discipline always seems painful rather than pleasant at the time. But later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees, and make straight the paths of your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather healed. Pursue peace with everyone, and the holiness without which no one will see the Lord." What an admonition to create peace within families and within other systems, and to look at discipline as guidance, strengthen your weak knees and lift up your drooping hands. Can you just see this withered parent just going, strengthen your weak knees and lift up your drooping hands and get it, because the righteousness will follow. That doesn't mean, I always have to put a disclaimer, that does not mean that even if you do all of those things, that something cannot still go awry with your child. There are inborn qualities of some children, and those will happen whether you do your best discipline job or not. But I think what this tells us is do it. Just do it. Do the discipline, the guidance that comes as your responsibility as a parent or as your responsibility to yourself. Okay, so you've been whipped down now. Strengthen your weak knees, lift up your drooping hands, and go for it. living that disciplined life because of the righteousness that will follow.
Discipline is seen as positive.
Right.
So it's negative thing.
Right.
Although kids might think it's negative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. It is not always, what does it say? Discipline is not always pleasant at the time, but later it will yield the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it.
As long as you don't say it hurts me more than it hurts you.
Yeah. Any thoughts about discipline or thinking about discipline from the biblical perspective? Biblical perspective, or...
Faith itself is a discipline. It means setting aside time for worship. Living the kind of life that God leads us to live, which may not necessarily, just live any old way, but God has certain ways that we're to live and interact with them. So faith itself is a discipline.
Yes, our own faith is a discipline, and that speaks to our own spiritual health, as we were talking about in a session on health and wellness and nurturing yourself, and that the discipline piece does not only fit in for parents disciplining children, but it fits in for us, for ourselves, in disciplining us to spirituality and to spiritual understandings and spiritual times and finding meaning and leading that disciplined life, whether it's difficult. I mean, it's not always easy to live the faith life in our culture. It is not always easy to resist some of those, the cosmopolitan temptations of whatever, Fifth Avenue or Madison Avenue or whatever the avenue is in your community. But we are called to be, we are. What is it that John Tran says? We are not called to be successful, we are called to be faithful. We don't necessarily always meet the goals. We don't always meet the success goals of the culture, but we can meet the faithfulness goals. The goals of leading a faith life within our culture, which sometimes is different and sometimes a lot more fulfilling. So, any other thoughts on discipline? Yes?
We had 5 children fairly close together, so they sort of have to be disciplined for me to survive.
Yes.
And I remember thinking that they were actually, once accepted that this was, we go to bed on time, we get up at a reasonable hour, we eat meals together as a family, we have reasonable celebrations, and then they were easy to take places, because they sort of knew that, even though we didn't have very good furniture, I didn't let them jump on ours because I figured we might be somewhere where we have very good stuff. And if they knew they didn't jump on furniture, that would be good. I really felt that once, I always tell our oldest child that, I felt sort of bad for him because I felt like maybe we were a little harder on him, but once you set the pattern that you do have to mind and that sort of thing, but, I think they had a lot of fun. They were easy to take and we did a lot of things and they were fun, but we could do that because there were limits that they knew and understood.
And children need those limits.
Yeah.
And so do families.
And we enjoy them.
Right.
You can enjoy them a lot more.
Yeah.
If there really is some limits.
Right. Yeah. Good. Thanks. Any other thoughts? Okay, we'll move on to empowering. And I've just given a little introductory line there. God teaches the children of Israel, allows them to fail, and institutes consequences for their failures. At the same time, God shows tremendous love, patience, and forgiveness. In Romans, who will separate us from the love of Christ? Will hardship, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword?
No.
No. Not even those will separate us. And then in verse 38, for I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Nothing can separate us. And how empowering that is. I think particularly of the need to have for women who have lived in abusive situations. Sometimes the whole climate of violence is so incredibly oppressive that it will take a long time to work on giving this back. I talked to one of the staff people here who has worked in battered women's shelters, and she said, there are a couple camps in terms of philosophy. She is a social worker, and I happen to be friends with a few social workers who talk about some of them, depending on the agencies they work in, do not bring religion into the treatment plan. Some of them do. And the staff person who was here said she worked with women in a battered women's shelter in Washington, D.C. as part of the Lutheran Volunteer Corps. And that for the women there, by and large, the majority needed to have their religion be part of their healing. To have some sense of empowerment, of value, no matter what happens in life, no matter how many times they feel like they failed themselves by going back into this abusive relationship and taking their children back in there and gone at it again and again and again, God will not leave you even then, even when you go against all the treatment plans and all the regimes that are set before you. Even then, God will not leave you. God will be there with you through all of that. And will be there with you through your healing and the tough times that come for women who escape abusive relationships. Okay, and then educating, for those of you who are education areas. Proverbs again. My child, keep your commandment and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Bind them up upon your heart always. Tie them around your neck. These necks, these chests are heavy with all these things tied around. When you walk, they will lead you. When you lie down, they will watch over you. And when you awake, they will talk with you. For the commandment is a lamp, and the teaching a light. And the reproofs of discipline are the way of light. Isn't that neat? The lamp is the commandment, and the teaching a light. And the reproofs of discipline are the way of life. So for those of you who are teaching your children or teaching other people's children, facts can come and go. But the teaching and the feeling that one has and the learning experience for children and for adults doesn't go away. When you are here at Holden and when you sit in a variety of sessions, you may not always remember all of the facts that are discussed, but you remember that feeling, the feeling of learning, the feeling of learning something new, and the feeling of the sense of this is how my life can be guided. That will go with you as the light and the lamp of learning. So, and then Colossians. Let the word of Christ, this is another children's choir song that we sing, so that goes through my head. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly. Let me be able to see the word of Christ in you. Teach and admonish one another in all wisdom, and with gratitude in your hearts, sing, see the spell checker doesn't yet catch all those. Sing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs to God. And then in protecting, two Luke texts. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. This is where we are given the sense of the animal kingdom and what the hen does to gather her brood, and you were not willing, the text says. With the spirit and the power of Elijah, I will go before you to turn the hearts of parents to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. So sometimes we have to remember that we can do all that we can as human parents, but we have to pray for the spirit to be there, because sometimes it's the spirit that makes the movement, and makes the movement within the child or within the other that makes the difference. And then nourishing, and there's a fly. Is there anyone among you, if your child asks for a fish, will give a snake instead of a fish? Or if the child asks for an egg, will give a scorpion? If you then, who are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will the Heavenly Father give the Holy Spirit to those who ask him? And Matthew, when it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and the hour is now late. Send the crowds away so that they may go into the villages and buy food for themselves. And Jesus says, "They need not go away. You give them something to eat." And then the miracle happens.
2 weeks ago.
Pardon?
That was the sermon 2 weeks
yes, ago. Yes, right. The loaves and the fishes and how that miracle transpired. But, you know, that was an incredibly nurturing thing for Jesus to do. Okay, don't send them away. They want to be here. They want to see these miracles. They want to be part of this historical time. And don't send them away. Let's just feed them. You know, I remember when I read the story of the loaves and the fishes, I am reminded of my grandmother, who could throw a dinner together in an instant for a crowd of many people. And I remember her always talking about, she was 84 when she died, but she was still cooking casseroles for every event that happened at the church. And she would talk about these younger women. Of course, you know, my mother and I are around here, and she's, "Oh, these young women," she said, "they just don't get it." She said, "When somebody calls you to do a casserole, just do it," she said. And she would get so irritated at all of the people making excuses not to do things. And she would just say, "Well, just tell them to get on with it. Do it. Put it together." And I'm reminded of the loaves and fishes story. Or of her when I read the loaves and fishes story, because she was a person who truly took that to heart. And when someone had a need, she was there. She just made the casseroles, or she brought the pickles, or she did those kinds of things. That was who she was, and that is how I grew up in my family. And she took her commitment very, very seriously. We talked to her about what the lives of those young women were like, and we we did the rationalizing that we could with her, but at that point in her life, she was just not willing to accept it. She said, "You know, it is their responsibility, and it's time for them to do it." So, and she said, "I'm getting too old for this," but, you know, here she is at 83, helping the church kitchen, throwing corn and potatoes together, and doing all of those things that she loved to do. She truly loved to do it, too. And she was needed. She felt needed. So that was kind of her mission too. Yeah. You have some of those in all your churches? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then let's see. Accessibility and presence. And by accessibility, what I talk about that is, it is having someone available to nurture you within the setting. And let's see, my presence will go with you and I will give you rest, Exodus. And this is one of the few Old Testament accounts that I listed. And then in Luke, a great windstorm arose and the waves beat into the boat and Jesus was sleeping, so that the boat was already being swamped, but he was in the stern asleep on the cushion. And they woke him up and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care? We are perishing." He woke up and rebuked the wind and said, "Peace, be still." Then the wind ceased and there was a dead calm. I can just see it. You know, there he is, laying, peacefully sleeping. I think this is the parent, you know, who is sleeping and, you know, mommy, get up. Don't you see there's a storm? And so he wakes up and, "Peace, be still." And those are the kinds of things that give images of Jesus as such a caring person, at least. But he was asleep, so they did have to wake him up to pay attention to what was happening. Any thoughts about the biblical model of nurturance?
I think the accessibility has to be also for the nurturer to be around when they want to nurture. I know as a teacher, one of the best things we do is listen to the kids' stories.
Yes.
And they can be long-winded. But they don't get that kind of listening at home. Their parents are too busy. They pick them up from the Y Care, and they get them home, they give them dinner, they, you know, they do laundry or whatever, and they put them to bed. Mm-hmm. They don't have any of that time with adults.
Yeah.
So we have gotten the retired Calm Stars, I can't remember the whole thing, those retired people, and they come up once a week. They're the grandmas in India. They come up and they volunteer in our rooms, and I just let them go around and talk to anyone they want to talk to, and they're like, the kids just warm up to them, and I ask the ladies, "Can you be called grandma rather than their names?" And they just glow in it, they have all this attention, and the kids just have someone to talk to. So, I mean, that accessibility is something that's really hard in this day and age.
Right, it is truly. And sometimes parents say, "Well, just, you know, does that truly mean that I have to be there at every waking moment?" No, it doesn't. But it does mean that it is very important for your child to know where you are, if they need you, how can they call you, particularly as we have these teenagers now who want to be very independent. They don't want to even listen to where you are, but I do tell them anyway, because I feel that even if they say they don't want to know where we are, they want to know where we are. They want us to be accessible to them, and they want to be able to call us or connect with us in some way, shape, or form. I'm going back to school in the fall to the University of Minnesota for my PhD in nursing, and that was one of the things. Once I was accepted to the program, that the kids said, "Okay, now we need a cell phone, because we want to be able to connect with you, and we want to know how to connect with you when you might be on the road and when you might be away." And for us, that will be an important part of having me accessible to my children, even on the day. I'm only going away one day a week to do this, but they want to know where I am and what's happening on that day. And you may have similar instances in your lives with people who want to know where you are. You know, maybe it's now your adult children who want to know what your schedule is, where you're going to be, you know, when you're going to Holden, when you're on vacation, and you think, now why do they have to know these things? Because they really want to still be nurtured by you. And they want to nurture you back.
Doesn't that go two ways?
Yes.
If you tell them where you are, they're more open to telling you where they are.
Right.
And want to know where they are.
Yeah. And as your relationship changes, as you go from being the parent of younger children to being the parent of people who are 40 and 45, there's still that connection that has been built between you, and you want to know. I mean, I'm really irritated when I find out my parents have gone someplace and I don't know. And we live 4 hours away. You know, I think, well, I mean, if they've gone on a long trip, not if they've gone, you know, just a short thing, but sometimes they'll go to the Mayo Clinic and have their physical, and I don't know about it. That really irritates me. You know, those kinds of things where I think, well, Paul, I would have liked to have known that. I might have gone over and spent a day with you and, you know, had lunch or done some of those kinds of things. So, yes.
But when you stay in touch that way, the most amazing things happen that you don't expect. When I was telling my dad that we were coming up here, that we were vacationing at Lake Chelan. My family doesn't go to church, so I wasn't going on and on about this beautiful village. But that we were coming up here to Lake Chelan. He goes, oh, are you going to Stehekin? And I thought, he knows this place, because that's not a name that just rolls off your lips. And I said, well, actually, no, we get off at this other stop, and we're going up to the Holy Village. And he goes, you know, I used to work in that area at a copper mine. And so then I called Jennifer to make sure, because we live in northern Idaho, and there are, like, lots of silver mines. There were, there aren't any more. But, you know, so I didn't know if there was more than one mine in this area. And called him back and said, that's the one, Dad. You know, so he was having the greatest time reminiscing about that part of his life, which was a part of his life I had never heard of before. And I was, you know, just enjoying that, listening to it, and knowing another part of my father that, you know, he's nearly 80 and I had never heard before. So it can be beneficial in ways one doesn't know.
That whole accessibility piece, I think, is a real big challenge in this fast-paced, technologically advanced world. So I think it's a challenge, yes.
Go back to that abuse situation where you have to remind women or whatever of the love of Christ, but it seems to me so many of them don't know it in the beginning, and somehow or another, how do you explain to this woman, kids or whatever, that have been beat out of it, whatever, of Christianity and the love of Christ.
Right. That truly then is a mission, and so that's why I am really quite supportive of the, you know, the church's involvement in caring for women who have been in situations of violence for that reason. Some of them have never heard it. I mean, can you imagine? Now, some of you may have had this experience. Can you imagine? I can't, because I grew up in the church. I grew up knowing the story about the sparrow. I grew up knowing about the hairs on my head. I grew up knowing that neither life nor death nor angels
Jesus,
nor principalities.
Yes, I know.
Right. I grew up knowing that. Yeah. Can you imagine growing up without that? When you grow up without that, and you grow up in this individualized culture where nobody cares, it's going to take a long time to get that message across. And so that's why in those systems, and particularly in the, you know, with the professionals who work with those people, it's a long and arduous task. That is why, you know, this man who's beating her up may be the only one who has ever shown her any kind of affection. And yet he beats her up. But that's what she knows, and she doesn't know this other piece. And or if she grew up, you know, there are situations in which people have grown up with kind of a warped sense of religion. That's my own bias, but that has promoted male power over women, and that takes even longer to get over. Because that's a deeply inborn, inbred kind of background. But yeah, so.
Or parental power, too.
Right. Parental power, which maybe transfers to the spouse then, and, you know, eventually. So. Well, I'd like to close with my little story from my 11-year-old girl who tells us little pieces of her last surgeries. I can't remember much about my last surgery, except that my friend, whose mom is a flight attendant, came and visited us in the hospital. He lives in Florida, too. I was on a liquid diet in case they needed to operate on my stomach. He and I went out to eat together the day before surgery, but I couldn't eat. I felt like I was going to die of hunger. After he left, it was time for my surgery. I don't remember the beginning, but I do remember what happened after. My aunt sent me a Play-Doh set from Las Vegas. A couple of times a year, I get together with other friends who had the same kinds of surgery. It's fun because Aaron, one of my best friends, is there. Aaron has played an important role in my healing. We talk about stuff a lot, and she has also visited me in the hospital. She's a very good friend because she has the same medical history as me, and we understand each other. When something is painful or boring, you never forget it. I think I remember all this stuff because they were both. I also mention friends a lot because friends play a huge role in my recovery. For instance, one of my best friends, Leah, would visit me frequently when I was in the hospital. I think she helped me recover mentally by cheering me up. I think my play lady, Lynn, helped me, keeping me occupied and keeping my mind off the hospital. She let me play Super Nintendo for hours. I know this is normally a bad thing for kids, but it is good for me in the hospital. I think parents should always listen to their kids, and if they refuse the tests, parents should not agree to do the test. They should start letting children be part of making the decisions at age 9, because they are able to be that, to by that age, make good decisions. There was a doctor who would wake me up at, this is my favorite, there was a doctor who would wake me up at 5 o'clock in the morning just to ask me how I was doing. Have any of you been there?
Yes.
I said, I was doing just fine until you came in here and woke me up. I thought the guy looked like a chipmunk. So I put a sign on my door that said, no chipmunks allowed until 8 a.m. He never came back early in the morning again. In conclusion, this is the story of my medical life. Some of it won't be super clear because I wasn't old enough to remember all the details. I am who I am today because my mom helped me through all these struggles. Isn't that just a neat story? And there's more. I mean, it's thicker and deeper. But I think what it shows is the importance of the role of nurturing in her recovery. She's been through many, many, many surgeries, and she's only 11. And can be that articulate and creative to write a story that certainly shares with me as a healthcare provider how important it is to listen to her and to her needs and to her mother and to her mother's needs and her family. This is a book that is in the bookstore, Nurturing the Spirituality in Children. And this has some activities and examples that you might want to consider in working with children. It's kind of like object lesson type things, and it suggests that parents do these kinds of things 10 minutes a day with their children. And they're very simple and very easy. And I think most families would enjoy something like this. And to remember that it is, you know, the spirituality dimension is a part of our lives, just as important to consider as the physical recovery and the emotional recovery, and lest we spend some more time on spiritual development in children. And I dare say that whoever does this will also have a sense of their own spiritual development, because children will be teachers as well as learners in those situations. Any other thoughts? Tomorrow I don't have a session. Friday we are talking specifically about parenting and nurturant parenting and some ideas related to that. So, and Saturday morning we're talking about nurturing within the ethical perspective. And this has been a fun week for me. Unfortunately, I teach opposite Ted Peters many times, but I'm really having fun going to the sessions of his that I do, because when I consider ethics and look at ethical decision-making from my practice perspective and from family and situational perspectives, the nurturing relationship is an integral part of the ethical decision-making. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that on Saturday. Saturday morning before the bus leaves and all of that. So thanks for coming, and welcome. And take this handout if you want to and use it at home, or share it with someone else who could use it. And think on it a bit. There are some nice, you can look at it and get a sense of some passages on either side of it as well to ground you in the story. Thank you.
Thank you.